This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The body camera pilot program for Town of Normal Police has turned up an unanticipated benefit for officers.
I mean, if you went on a typical domestic call and you were there for 45 minutes, I mean, you cut that in half, it's a considerable time savings, especially if you've got multiple officers on scene.
Police Chief Rick Bleichner talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about the time savings body cameras can provide. The spring legislative session is coming to a close. Will anything get done? The IPR Politics Roundtable will try to answer that question. And get a preview of a weekend event celebrating the Parklands Foundation Merwin Preserve. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 8th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. This week on Sound Ideas, you'll hear from police agencies with pilot programs for officer body cameras. Normal's police pilot project rolled out about 8 months ago. Six officers use them daily. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Police Chief Rick Bleichner says the findings are twofold.
It's helping, obviously, capture some very good evidentiary things for court and for documentation purposes. But also one of the things, when you look with a new program, you certainly think there's benefits administratively. Obviously, we want to have better documentation. We want, to refute our officers' action, whether it be citizen complaints or when it comes time for court. But you also look for those little wins, because if it's all administratively heavily cited, you got to have some wins for the officers or the people, the line officers who are the ones using them, to make it to help sell the how beneficial the program is. One of the things that we found that really is kind of it makes sense, but we didn't think about it initially, was that it cuts down on the time that officers have to spend on certain calls. So previously, for example, you'd go to, say, a domestic call, and you would separate the parties, you would talk with them, you would find out generally what happened and occurred. If there were some injuries or there was damage to property, you would go to the car and get your camera and photograph that. Then you would take statements from individuals. Now when the officers arrive on scene, they have their body cameras on. They notify them that they're being audio and video recorded, and they go right into what happened, how did it happen, and they can ask some very pointed follow-up questions. If there's injuries, they can document those injuries. If there's damage, they can document those. So what we're finding from the officers who are in the test, who are in the pilot program, is that it cuts down about half the time on a lot of these calls. So if they're spending half the time on some of those, it's more time that they can spend doing other things.
So but how many minutes? What sort of what is half the time?
Yeah, if you went on a typical domestic call and you were there for 45 minutes, I mean, you cut that in half, it's a considerable time savings, especially if you've got multiple officers on scene.
Sometimes, though, in calming the situation, longer is better for an officer's presence. Are you losing that?
I think it's probably that balance. I think there's times when calming and having an officer presence is certainly beneficial. There's other times when our presence alone helps to continue to fan that flame and not allow things to settle down sometimes, because, you know, we're going into some situations where sometimes neither party wants us there. And so I think in even the officer's best intentions, sometimes it's a contentious call in those cases. So I look at it from an officer safety standpoint, that the less time that they have where they're in those situations where they're having to deal with that, it's going to be safer for them. It's going to be better for the community. And it's going to be more efficient for us.
Other takeaways from body cam pilot project?
Oh, I think the other things administratively, it allows us to document much better the actions that our officers are having with individuals out there, good and bad. And again, from a training standpoint, it allows us to catch things early, which is the the benefit, I think, if you have somebody who's interacting with somebody in a situation, you think, okay, you know, as a supervisor, they're reviewing the tape, and they say, you know, in this situation here, maybe you could have said this a little bit differently, or maybe if you would have said that, it could have diffused things a little better, because we're always looking to de-escalate. I think the other thing is it helps us, because from what I've seen, when we have to use force in situations, it does a better job or showing in the moment what was going on, what was said, and actually a lot of times how quickly things do go from somewhat relative calm and order to needing to use force and take things under control and control the situation pretty quickly. So I think from that standpoint, again, it helps protect our officers and helps protect the department, and it helps – it's kind of that check and balance too, that if there's a question or concern out there, that video is there to help document it.
Give me an example of what you just mentioned.
Yeah, previously, unless it happened on a traffic stop, we would have a situation, and I say on a traffic stop because we did have audio and video recording on those, although the camera was fixed in the squad car. Previously, what you would have is you would have the officer's report saying, I arrived on scene, here's the situation as I saw it, here's what the individual did, which led to me using this type of level of force. Now we can kind of see that firsthand. We can see the report doesn't always accurately reflect how quickly things happen. And so when you're reading the report that an officer shows up on the scene and that a person approaches them with a clenched fist, says that they're going to do whatever to the officer and comes at them in an aggressive manner, you read that and it paints a certain picture. But when you actually see it in real time, when you watch it on the video, it makes you appreciate how quickly things happen in a lot of cases and how short a time the officer had to make a decision on what am I going to do to control this situation.
Let's back up to the lower key kinds of incidents too that you mm-hmm. mentioned and the usefulness of body cams in training. Is that going to become part of the performance reviews with coachings or mm-hmm. periodic coachings of young or even mid-career officers about use of verbal jiu-jitsu or de-escalation or just finessing a community interaction in a friendlier way than the formal cop speak that often happens?
Yeah, and I think we've been doing that for quite a while. I mean, again, with the in-car cameras, we've been using that as a good teaching tool, training tool, like you said, coaching tool. This just helps us expand that. I mean, obviously, it's not just a vehicle stops now. It can be any police interaction. So it's going to be able to allow the supervisors to have a better gauge because they can't always be on those calls. But again, it's going to be something that, you know, we're going to be able to utilize again to the officer's benefit.
So how formal is the mechanism? How do supervisors routinely mm-hmm. work the footage in?
Yeah, I mean every month on a basic level they go through and review in-car cameras for officers and they review body cameras at this point. What will happen is once we roll it out to all staff and that staff will be using it, that'll just be again incorporated into it as every month the supervisor will go in and review videos from each officer and look through those to make sure again that the equipment's working properly, and then that the officers are conducting themselves and handling things procedurally and operationally in a way that we would expect them to do that. It's even more critical, I think, when you've got young officers who are in field training, or once they get released from field training and they're kind of on their own, the supervisors can review those and utilize those kind of as another supervisor, if you will, because although they can't be there all the time, they can utilize that again to help kind of guide that officer as they learn and develop and in their own style and of policing. Our officers at this point, at least the ones that are utilizing the pilot, seem to have some very positive feedback from it. And I've got a lot of officers who are questioning, hey, when are we going to be rolling this out? When are we going to department-wide? So that's encouraging.
Leading to the question, when are you going to do that?
Yeah, well, at this point, I mean, We still have some issue. We're looking through with our vendor now. They have a new product that's coming out. And when I say new product, basically there is a longer battery life. And so we're always looking for that opportunity because the state statute says it has to be able to operate and record for 10 hours. If we can get something that'll record for 12 hours, well, that's even better. So our current vendor has a new product that's out, and we're in the process of receiving those and testing those to see how they go.
Town of Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner, he estimates the department is looking to deploy body cams for all officers within 6 months if the new tests on battery life go well. The estimated costs in the neighborhood of $93,000 for cameras and $40,000 for storage. Later this week, GLT's Charlie Schlenker also talks with Bloomington Police Sergeant Clayton Arnold and Chief Brendan Hefner about the body cam tests experience in that city. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up here about the day-long celebration called Merwin in May. The Merwin Preserve is part of the Parklands Foundation, and that's coming up during an edition of GLT's Datebook. I'm Mike McCurdy. Reporters in Springfield spend a lot of time trying to read the budget tea leaves. This week's Illinois Politics Roundtable is no exception as the spring session starts to accelerate to an end. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the panel, including Charlie Wheeler of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS, Tony Arnold of WBEZ, and IPR's Brian Mackey, who starts off by asking, are they going to get something done?
I'll give you my standard answer. I have no idea. All expectations have been dashed time and again, but there are apparently negotiations going on in the Senate, and the Rauner administration is involved in that about... It's not entirely clear what they're trying to do, you know, pass a budget as well as sort of revive the grand bargain. I'm picturing that old TV show Emergency where they have those paddles, they rub them together and stick them on the chest, clear, and trying to get some life back into this idea of some sort of trade-off of some of the non-budget items that Governor Bruce Rauner has been pushing for, such as a property tax freeze, changes to the workers' compensation system, changes to Illinois' government pension systems, as well as tax increases of some sort or another. Exactly what remains in flux, and spending cuts in state government, which of course we've had 22 months of a budget impasse where you've had sort of some areas of state government have been slashed, like human services, higher education. Other areas of state government have been spending willy-nilly, such as state employee paychecks. So that is apparently being negotiated, but I'm not going to be super optimistic until I actually see a bill getting put on the floor and put up for votes.
And Tony, are you hearing anything different on that?
No, I guess what I'd say is, during this, it's been every week there's something new about the consequences of this that in theory is going to put pressure on the people who pass budgets to actually, you know, do something other than what they've been doing for 22 months. And this week, the consequences that we learned that some doctors who provide Medicaid services, see Medicaid patients in Illinois, are not getting paid. And they're not getting paid so much that they're saying, we're not going to see any more Medicaid patients. There's been a court filing that was made in federal court in Chicago from 25 different healthcare organizations saying how much they're owed by the state of Illinois and how long it's taken. The most extreme example was that it's been 7 months since they got paid for their Medicaid services. The insurance giants, Aetna, Meridian, Family Health Network, these are all managed care organizations that deal directly with Medicaid patients. $650 million owed to Aetna. The state owes Meridian $557 million. Family Health Network, $213 million. These are large amounts for these giant organizations. So they're saying that they're not now reimbursing doctors for seeing Medicaid patients. And as a result, the doctors are saying, just now saying, well, we can't rely on this, so we're not going to see some of these Medicaid patients. There's one provider in Grays Lake, Illinois, in Chicago's northern suburbs. 2,000 Medicaid patients there are at risk of losing their or having to switch their doctor. It's all over the state, and actually it's outside of state. Community health care in Davenport, which sees 10,000 Illinois Medicaid patients, is owed $560,000. There's Heartland Health in Peoria, $265,000 there. There's Touchette Hospital in East St. Louis, $8 million, 100,000 Medicaid patients. It's all over. And so this is new information now that they're not going to they're going to stop seeing Medicaid patients if this keeps going on.
And Charlie, let me go to you real quick, because this is always an issue as far as, the treatment of Medicaid patients. Doctors are paid less than they are for many, seeing many other patients. But this is a big deal when you think of how many people in the state of Illinois are on Medicaid. And it's been a growing number.
Yeah, I don't have the exact figure at hand, but it's in excess of 1 million people. The vast majority of them are children and moms, although the percentage-wise, higher amounts are spent to care for the elderly. But it's just a symptom of what's going on across the state. And Tony was talking about how people are having to wait 7 months, some of these managed care organizations. Well, there's been no appropriation for state employees for their group insurance, and so the delays in paying those providers are in excess of a year, and in certain instances, more than 2 years. So this is a situation that is causing a lot of harm to a lot of people, and it's going to continue to get worse until the General Assembly and the governor reach an agreement to fund these services.
And let me go back to you, Tony, because you were saying how the pressure that's on some of these lawmakers to get some type of deal, something worked out to try to alleviate some of these issues. Are you hearing from any of them? Or have you talked to some of those and get a feel of whether or not something like a Medicaid lawsuit would help that situation and try to put more pressure on them?
What these Medicaid providers are asking is to be put to the front of the line by the comptroller, to basically be paid, have a federal judge mandate that the state pay them before other things. This has happened for a few other services too. But what happens when there's no more money? Basically, you're at the front of the line and you're still having to wait several months, which is what's going on because the backlog of bills is just getting longer and longer and longer. The longer we go without a budget. I talked to Greg Harris, who's the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee for basically Medicaid services, who, he basically said, well, the answer to this solution, or to this problem, rather, is to pass a budget. He didn't have anything more insightful to say than that. And so does this build up enough pressure to actually get some sort of deal? I don't know. This has been building for so long. It's just kind of inching closer and closer and closer to some sort of cliff. It's just taken us 22 months to get to where we are now. Greg Harris is saying, well, when you have some of the largest corporations in the world, like Aetna or Meridian, talking about, not paying doctors to see Medicaid patients, well, that's significant. Maybe that's going to do something, but I think it partially depends on what this federal judge says next week when they're in court.
Once again, showing that it would be a judge or a court who has sort of a potentially decisive role in, or at least a significant role in how this budget stalemate is playing out. Remember, it's a judge and a state judge in St. Clair County who has authorized earlier this year. The figure was $3 billion in state employee paychecks to go out during the budget impasse. A lot of the money that's been spent on healthcare and other caring for the disabled in Illinois has gone out under judicial orders, and it's because the legislators have not been able to come to an agreement. Tony talked about this sort of every week. There's another I don't know if revelation is the right term, but consequence, or it comes into public consciousness that these consequences are out there. There was an interesting hearing where there actually was some bipartisan agreement this week, and it's the opposite end. Tony was talking about these huge international companies that owed hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, the state also owes less than $3 million in chunks as small as $5,000 to $220,000 to 18 men who were wrongfully convicted of crimes later found innocent. So these are not people who there was like some kind of legal technicality or something like that. They were, often taken up cases for free by these innocence projects around the state, and they were exonerated. They got certificates of exoneration. They say the process essentially requires them to sort of, after they get out of prison, they have to go back before a judge and sort of reprove their innocence. They get the certificate. They go to the Illinois State Court of Claims. State law says, based on how long you were incarcerated, you get a set amount of money. For over 14 years, the amount is $220,000. Some of these men spent as much as 25 years wrongfully in prison before they were exonerated and freed. And when you get out of prison, you have nothing. You don't even get bus fare like you do if you are, just coming to the end of your normal prison term. One guy told me he had $14.70 in his prison account, and they basically opened the door, handed him the money, and said, leave. So, they have been waiting during the budget impasse to get their compensation. Senator Donnie Trotter from Chicago has a bill up that would make this a continuing appropriation so that, even if the legislature doesn't pass a budget, much like pension payments, legislator paychecks, a few other things, bond payments, it would become an automatic payment for the state of Illinois. And although there was some initial resistance, it seemed like there might be yet another partisan breakdown on this bill. The Republicans appeared to be moved by the story they heard from an exoneree, a man who'd been in prison for 25 years. And it was a unanimous bipartisan vote to approve this in committee. Now it still has to get through the full Senate, still has to get through the House, still has to be signed by the governor before it would become law. But it shows that, on some things, there is some penetrating of the political minds set around here, and that, perhaps it's a small amount of money. So I don't know how much you can extrapolate that, but there was at least a tiny, tiny amount of bipartisan cooperation on something related to state
spending. I got the impression, too, from reading some of the comments of the lawmakers, that the attitude was colored by the fact that these individuals were not there of their own choosing, unlike some business that signs a contract with the state. And you might say, well, should have known that the state's a deadbeat, so you're taking your chances when you sign something with Illinois. These individuals were innocent people plucked off the street by overzealous law enforcement, and through no fault of their own, they're in this situation. And that struck me as one of the things that maybe contributed to the bipartisanship.
Charlie, it was interesting how that evolved, because Senator Chapin Rose, who's the on this particular Senate Budget Committee, is the ranking Republican member, he initially expressed some skepticism and said, I'm angry about your case. It's terrible that this is happening. But if we make this special, case continuing appropriation for exonerees, aren't, human services have terrible stories to tell, too. And he seemed to be heading towards a no vote. Then a different Republican Senator Dan McConkie, I believe from the suburbs, made that point that you were repeating, Charlie, about how, it's different when even a nonprofit human service, do-gooder agency signs a contract with the state. That's different than somebody who was snatched off the street wrongfully, framed essentially, or at least, convicted on bad information at best, and spends potentially decades in prison. That's a different situation. And you could see the Republicans sort of like walking back, and Senator Chapin Rose ultimately said, this is a different case. We should support this bill.
IPR's Brian Mackey with the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Joining him were Tony Arnold of WBEZ, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and moderator Sean Crawford of IPR. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Mike McCurdy. One way the University of Illinois has been able to weather uncertain state funding over the past several years is by increasing international enrollment. International students at the U of I pay a tuition rate more than twice as high as in-state students, and international student enrollment at the U of I has gone from about 5,000 students a decade ago to more than 12,000 students today. But there's concern across the country that international student enrollment could drop with new attitudes and policies regarding immigration in the Trump administration. IPR's Brian Moline spoke with Governing Magazine staff writer Alan Greenblatt about his recent article on the subject. Greenblatt says international enrollment at American universities has skyrocketed over the last decade.
The numbers have nearly doubled, not quite doubled, too. There are now more than a million international students at U.S. colleges and universities, and the growth has been very strong. Certainly, the University of Illinois is one of the top five importers, if you will, of foreign students, with about 12,000 students out of 44,000 on campus. So it's a big share. Higher education is always one of the first things that states cut. It's always a popular target because higher ed has separate revenues. They can raise tuition. So rather than raising tuition on in-state students as much, they recruited more out-of-state students. And we've seen this huge boom, you know, from California and Washington to Florida, and not just at major universities. It was small regional colleges that had probably never seen foreign students now have a pretty good population, with a lot of them coming from China.
Certainly not only, you know, the enrollment numbers, but some other numbers that really stood out in your article to me was just the amount of financial impact that those international students have on the communities. Certainly we've seen that here in Champaign-Urbana with all the building on Green Street.
Well, that's right. You have those high-rise towers now. I mean, people kept saying to me when I was in town, we never used the word skyline before, and now we do. So you have these, you know, two-story buildings, but suddenly next door to 15-story buildings, and mainly with international students. And of course, not just for housing, but, you know, one of the local banks has Mandarin speakers on staff. I went to the BMW dealership just south of town, and, you know, although native middle-aged buyers are a bigger part of their market, they were going to be marketing specifically to female Chinese freshmen. And I asked why so specific, and they said, well, if you're a freshman, you might be in a dorm, but now you're ready to buy a car if you're moving out. And the dealer said, for some reason, the male students tend to drive up to Chicago or go up to Chicago to buy their cars, and the women were more likely to buy locally. And overall, the estimate that people seem to agree on is that international students pump about $30 billion into the U.S. economy.
I'm curious, Alan, when you were here, you know, in Urbana speaking to, you know, students, faculty, administrators, how concerned are they about what they've been hearing from the Trump administration in terms of immigration?
Very concerned, I would say. I mean, it's sort of a question we don't really know the answer to. What impact Trump will have on this whole phenomenon? But people assume it'll be negative, but we don't know how major it will be. So, I mean, certainly a lot of the rhetoric out of the administration has been hostile to immigrants, and it's not just a matter of students, but, you know, the administration has found ways to cut back on H-1B visas, which are the visas given to highly skilled workers. Often, you know, a huge number of engineers in Silicon Valley have H-1B visas. And that can be detrimental to recruiting students, because a lot of them come to the U.S. not only to get a quality education — our universities are seen as very strong all over the world — but also with hopes of staying here and working here. So if H-1B visas are diminished, that would make it harder for them to stay after graduation and to find jobs. And, you know, there's just sort of this general tenor of the country not seeming as welcoming and friendly. And so practically every student I talked to, even if they were from countries such as China or India, which are certainly not on any target list that the president has put out, they all certainly were very aware of it, and we're all talking about younger classmates or siblings back home who now were thinking about Canada or Australia or Europe, all of which are now marketing themselves aggressively, knowing that the U.S. could be leaving some business on the table, so to speak.
So I guess for colleges and universities here, you know, they're getting to the point where, you know, for next school year, students are, you know, accepting offers and deciding where to go to school. I imagine there are some nervous administrators right now.
Yeah, everyone is very nervous. They don't know. I mean, most of the applications had to be, you know, most schools' applications had to be in around December. So it was before Trump even took office. It was certainly before he put out his, you know, so-called ban on 6 and 7 Muslim countries. But they have a term called yield, which is how many of the kids that you accept actually make commitments and come to university. So they're just finding that out now. And, of course, everyone is nervous for next year. You know, will applications fall off? And there was a survey done of about 250 colleges and universities, and it found that 40% of them had seen drops in applications from international students, and that got a lot of attention. Of course, the same survey showed that almost the same number, 35%, saw more applications. So right now we don't know, but administrators are really, really scared. Like, so this has become an important revenue source for universities. I mean, the universities still talk, of course, about it being important for diversity, and it's a way of exposing domestic students to a broader picture of the world. And you know, they hold to all those values, but they talk much more openly than they did a decade ago about how this is an important source of money, that dollars are tight for public-supported colleges and universities. And so, yeah, they're terrified that there'll be a drop-off in this market.
Alan Greenblatt is a staff writer with Governing Magazine. Greenblatt wrote a recent article on international student populations at U.S. colleges and universities. He spoke with IPR's Brian Moline. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Once upon a time, there were some eager gardeners who wanted to make something grow.
I planted roses.
I'm growing heirloom tomatoes.
Purple coneflower for me.
And they each ran into problems along the way.
Ew, black spots.
Wilt. So much wilt.
Is this supposed to be brown?
But I helped them out with that, and now their gardens really grow. My name is Murph. I can help you too. Send in your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Dr. Matt Fraker and his staff at the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center, protecting the human-companion-animal bond, caring for life of all kinds, and proud supporter of the Parklands Foundation. Details about the Parklands Nature Preserves at 454-8606. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Discover the beauty of one of Central Illinois' natural gems at a family event this weekend. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
You can get back to nature with the Merwin in May event coming up Saturday, May 13th from 9 a.m. to noon at the Merwin Preserve, which is part of the Parklands Foundation. Parklands Vice President Jessica Chambers says the event helps to celebrate the Parklands Foundation's 50th anniversary.
It was established by Loring Merwin, who was the publisher of the Pantograph, back in the 60s. And he established the Parklands Foundation in an effort to protect declining open space in central Illinois. And now we have, the Parklands Foundation has about 3,200 acres of habitat along the Mackinac River Valley in both McLean and Woodford County. I have a really cool piece of trivia, too.
Oh, yes?
Do you know that Loring Merwin was the great-grandson of Jesse Fell?
No way.
Yeah, it's so cool.
So when you support the Merwin Preserve, you know, you're basically keeping in touch with a guy who founded Normal and Illinois State University.
And our Fell Arboretum.
That's great.
It is. It kind of gives you chills.
It does. So at this event, there's all kinds of things going on.
So we are all there to talk to you about the birds and the animals and the Mackinac River. And it goes from 9 to noon, but it's kind of like an open house. So
oh, great.
You don't have to be there right at 9.
Nothing's formal at the Merwin.
No, not too much. We're asking people to park at the Money Creek Township Building, which you can go on to the Parklands website and see where that is. What we have planned there is we have a bunch of the other organizations that are affiliated with the Merwin Preserve are going to be there and have booths and talk to you about what they do.
So who's going to be there?
So we have Master Naturalists, Wild Ones, the Illinois Native Plant Society. So all those people will be there at the Money Creek Township building. This is a great place to go to the bathroom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
An inside thing there. It's a great place to go to the bathroom.
There's a real bathroom, and there'll be some porta potties.
Oh, so you don't have to go behind a tree.
Right,
gotcha.
Right. Okay. And so what we're going to do then is we have a school bus that's going to shuttle everybody from there to the north entrance. The plan is to have Guy Fraker. He's been with Parklands for 50 years. So he's going to be on that school bus to talk to you about Merwin when we drop you off, which is only really a couple minutes. But then again, when we pick you up on the school bus and then bring you back to the Money Creek Township building, we're going to go around the south side of the preserve, and then he can talk to you about, you know, the history, and you can ask your questions, because Guy should know the answer to any of the Parklands questions.
He knows it by heart.
Yeah. And then, so when we drop you off at the north entrance, we have a special treat.
Oh.
About every 15 minutes, we have a Parkland celebrity who will lead hikers.
Okay. What's a Parkland celebrity?
Okay. So I think you know a couple of these people.
Okay.
So like at 9 o'clock, Matt Fraker.
Oh, Guy's son, who's the veterinarian.
Yes, and you talk to him occasionally.
Yes. Yeah, so I have him on Animal House.
Right. So Matt Fraker will be there at 9. You know this one too. Don Schmidt,
the Dean of Green.
Yeah, he'll be there at 9:15. Do you know Dr. Given Harper?
Yes. Given Harper is with the Audubon Society. If you want to know anything about birds, you ask Given Harper.
You sure do. And so the idea is that the hike leaders will take you through the, you know, Merwin Preserve and answer your questions and talk about Merwin. If you choose to go alone, go alone. That is not a problem.
You could commune with nature.
You can commune with nature. If you want to go at a slower pace, or you want to go with your kids, whatever you want to do is fine. And then we have other board members scattered throughout the preserve to talk to you about, you know, the environment, the birds. For example, we have Dr. Caparella.
Angelo.
Yay! He's going to talk to you. He can talk to you about bats and mud puppies.
Mud puppies.
Mud puppies. The water creatures, the salamanders. I can't say anymore.
Okay. We don't want to ruin the surprise.
And then we have several board members that are biologists, and they're going to be down in the Mackinac that can talk to you about the creatures in the water. And so, you know, you can get up close to the river that morning as well. And there'll be a hospitality table. And then when you wind yourself back up, we'll take you to back to the bus and then bring you back to the township building.
Jessica, this sounds like a great event for the whole family.
It really is. That is my biggest hope, is to get families out there. I think for parents, you know, this is a great opportunity. Like, put all the electronics away. You need your car, but put everything else away. Grab a box of donuts and come out and see us for a couple of hours, because we are here to teach you and to share with you Merwin and a part of Central Illinois that I think is so beautiful and so important.
That's Jessica Chambers, Vice President of the Parklands Foundation. Merwin in May is Saturday, May 13th from 9 a.m. to noon. The event will go on, rain or shine. I'm Laura Kennedy.
It's recommended that you dress for the terrain, wear walking shoes rather than flip-flops, and feel free to bring your camera for shooting the wonders of the Merwin Preserve, but leave your pets at home. Dogs are not allowed. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Author Marcia Senatar is perhaps best known for her popular self-help book of the 1980s, Do What You Love, The Money Will Follow. Senatar, an educator and leadership consultant to corporations and other organizations, went on to write several books on how to live a more contemplative life. In her latest book, Dreams Unto Holiness, she explores how sleep can bring us important spiritual messages through our dreams.
I call it the holy dream, and the holy dream to me is where God, whatever your word or language for the creator, let's say, is present in our sleep. And now we all have this idea that God speaks to us all the time, and that we pray and we always get our answers. But really, when we're asleep, we're in another dimension, and our receptivity is different. Our intelligence is more of what I would call a spiritual intelligence. So how we know is part of a kind of exploration, a method that I'm suggesting in the new book. It's called Dreams Unto Holiness. And it's really how we tell the difference between a psychologically clarifying dream and a holy dream.
Well, how is this different from what Jung said, Carl Jung, the psychologist, said about the unconscious and dreams being kind of an entryway into the unconscious?
You know, I don't deal with the unconscious so much. I think I talk more about the psyche. The psyche for me, and I think this is standard, is the seat of our sensibility, our entire sensibility. So I'm not too concerned about unconscious versus conscious, because when we dream, things are brought into awareness. And I would use the word awareness more than conscious, unconscious. Unconscious also then gets into that hazy area of subconscious, which is has always been kind of murky to me. But
kind of the submerged feelings.
Yeah, something hidden, lurking there, you know. We don't know what it is. Is it there? Isn't it there? But when we talk about awareness, there's that crystal clear understanding that we all have, the aha moment.
Has something happened in your own life, or do you write about examples of people who have had dreams that gave them a spiritual message?
I talk about many, many examples. In fact, that's the only way I could explore the subject in this book, because otherwise it's too vague. But universally, there are patterns. Now, a psychological pattern might be, for example, we dream about losing our keys, or we might dream about failing a test or falling.
I've had all of those dreams.
We've all had all of those dreams. And Judy, all over the world, regardless of culture, these dreams follow humanity. And that's the beautiful thing about what I'm talking about. It's universal. But a spiritual dream would be like Saint Bosco, I believe. He dreamt as a child of animals that were hungry, and he was trying to feed them, or animals that were becoming tame. The lions were laying down with the lambs, so to speak. He didn't understand how that applied to him. And guides would show up in his dreams. And guides were, for him, the Virgin Mary, or Jesus, or Saint Francis. And they would talk to him about his dreams and his life. And little by little, he began to keep journals of these dreams, not about the specific dreams as much as the pattern of those dreams. And that's really what I'm talking about.
How did that affect St. John Bosco's life then?
Well, he turned from the, let's say, more everyday concerns to wanting to teach and reach others. In the psychologically clarifying dream, we're given information. If we use it with, let's say, a therapist, counselor, journaling, meditation, contemplation, and so forth, we gain information about our life. With the spiritual dream, we gain information about, and here's that theme again, who we are at the deepest level and how we contribute not only to ourselves, psychological, but to others, the greater good, spiritual. We learn about love, a kind of transcendent love, and that's the difference.
What about ordinary people? Do you go into the dreams of people that you know who are alive today?
Absolutely.
And what would they be like?
Well,
what would those dreams be like?
Let me just back up here for a second and say that the way this book came about was from my years, and I'm talking years here, of working with all ages and types of people, and every once in a while someone would say to me, you know, I can't get this dream out of my mind. It feels important. It feels meaningful. Okay, so that was a pattern I was hearing again and again and again. To your question, I remember one individual telling me, and this is in the book, this is not a spiritual dream, this is just a dream that they remembered, but it has ramifications. A homemaker was concentrating on the high price of a certain product, and she was thinking about it a lot, and that night in a dream she had a solution where she never had to buy that product again. All right, I'm not going to go into it, it takes too long, but that's the kind of thing where if we are focused on something, a question, for example, a problem, for example, And we go to bed, to sleep, with that question in our mind. Certainly prayer prior to sleep is one of the ways in which ordinary people get answers during sleep. I've heard many people tell me that they pray before sleep, wanting an answer, and during sleep, if not that night, then if they repeat the method over time, the answer will come in a dream. And of course, the language of dream is different than our cause and effect daily life language.
Explain that a little bit. Yeah, are there certain symbols that reappear or images?
Well, yes, and what I found, now there are many, many books coming up now with these symbols categorized. So that, for example, the lost key, the lost package, being lost, this could be one of two things. It could be you are in your psychological life, your psyche, feeling uncomfortable about your direction. You don't know your way. You can't find your way. But it could also be something deeper, that at the deepest level of your existence, your soul is telling you to get it together, choose more wisely, get clearer on your purposes, like that. So there are levels of meaning and levels of significance to our dreams. For example, a dream could just be undigested, you know, food, a pizza or a taco.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. We've been talking with the author Marcia Sinitar, who has a new book out about dreams and their possible spiritual messages. Has anybody that you've talked to gotten some sort of a direct, almost, communication, what they feel was a directive from God or however they experience the divine?
Yes, I would say many of the individuals that have confided in me have spoken of that, but I will say that in our culture, where we want things in a hurry, the holy dream is something that might roll out over 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Little by little, we're given information. And there's all sorts of evidence that people who are sensitive not only to dreams, but to art, to music, to walks in nature, to animals, colors, and creative people and musicians, artists like that, tend to dream more. They tend to be more adroit, adept at unraveling the mysteries. And a good friend, a trusted, qualified professional is indispensable in these conversations, because they do relate so far back into our life, so far back into childhood.
So what you're saying is it's good not to just hold on to this information that you get in dreams, but to share it with someone you trust, a spiritual director, a counselor, a psychologist.
I think it depends on the person. There are people that I've spoken to who have spoken to me, and this is certainly true of myself, who prefer, for the most part, to do their own analysis until they get stuck. Or if something is a red flag for them, let's say you wake up and you have a horrible feeling. It was a terrifying dream. It had a prophetic message. Maybe you dreamt you died. This is not usually predictive about about you. It's usually something that's transformative in your life. However, it's also good when you wake up with these strong, intense emotions to take it seriously. And the more strong the emotion, the more reason to go and consult a qualified professional.
Now, you just mentioned there's some things, there's some images or some dreams that are red flags. What are some of the common things that we should be listening to, so to speak, or paying attention to anyway, in our dreams?
Well, certainly the aftermath, what you wake up, how you feel when you wake up, the emotional tone, the climate. You go to bed, you go to sleep, and you're feeling fine. 8 hours later, you wake up and you're in a dead panic. All right, I think that's a good clue. Now, you asked earlier about symbols. The symbol aspect is interesting because we, all of us, have symbols that seem to crop up again and again, and they're personal to us. For example, a friend of mine who loves to cook has dreams about a New York deli. And the New York deli, she's there all the time in her dreams. And I find this extremely interesting because someone else has told me, a man I know, an executive, he dreams about roads and cars and wilderness areas. These are places that both parties have seen before in their life, but in the dreams, they're kind of mystically presented.
And that's where you have to sort of decide for yourself, what does it all mean? No one can tell you what your symbol means, I suppose.
I think that's true. I think it's very much like poetry. People will have different impressions of the images that the poet is talking about. And that's why we, you know, the phrase, know thyself. You have to kind of reach into yourself.
We should probably talk about that dreams are very significant throughout the Bible.
What I make of that is that this is not, you know, my hot idea, but this is something that is timeless, that there is a influence in our lives that is invisible, unrecognizable in daily life for the most part. But those of us who pray, and I'm one, will insist that there is an influence in our life from that prayer. And I'm suggesting, and of course Scripture was first to suggest that that influence is spiritual, meaning it animates our very essential soul to understand more deeply about the ultimate nature of reality.
And our relationship, perhaps, with God.
Well, that's the ultimate nature of reality, is God, to me.
We've been talking with Marcia Sinitar. She's the author of Dreams Unto Holiness, a book about the spirituality of our dreams. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Judy, for the time.
I'm Judy Valente.
Marcia Sinitar, based in California, is the author of more than 20 books about inner life. Her latest is Dreams Unto Holiness. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.